Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. Well, we're back from the break, and we have got a listener story extravaganza. So let's get to it.
It's party time!
We have news from me, a story from space, a wedding gone horribly wrong, Pavlov the dog, and a freaky ghost hunter adventure.
I expected so much more from you.
If that was not enough, Tom Williams is back with another installment of Growing Up. Now I know that you know what I'm going to say. Let's get it all going with another 5-minute mystery.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by poor Gregory Thorndike. We also have to acknowledge 1940s technology. Today, we do things very different, and time is not always on our side. Now, are you ready for today's tale?
Inspector Harris speaking. Yes? What? Gregory Thorndike murdered. What's the address? Yes? Yes, I'll be right over.
Inspector Harris is here, gentlemen.
Oh, yes, Oliver. Show him in.
This way, sir.
How do you do, Inspector Harris? Won't you come in? I'm James Thorndike, and this is my cousin, Robert Latimer.
How do you do?
Hello.
Mr. Thorndike, the coroner tells me your father died of stabbing.
That's right, Inspector. He'd been stabbed right through the heart.
Who discovered the body?
I did, sir.
Yes, Oliver?
It was around 8 this morning. I was taking up Mr. Thorndike's breakfast, as I do every morning, and found poor Mr. Thorndike with that knife sticking in him.
I see. Who is the last one to see him alive?
Well, I guess I am. I brought up Uncle's milk last night before I went to bed.
What time was that?
About 8:45.
And the coroner informs me he was killed about 11. Where were you three last night at about 11?
At 11? Why, I was at the movies.
Did anyone see you there?
No, not that I know of.
Mr. Latimer?
I'd gone to bed early last night, around 9. I slept right through the entire night until Oliver woke me this morning.
Well, Oliver, where were you at 11?
I was taking a walk. I felt a little groggy and wanted to get some fresh air.
I suppose no one saw you.
I'm afraid not, Inspector.
Well, this is swell. I've got 3 suspects and all have flimsy alibis. One of you is lying and I intend to... What's that?
Oh, that must be my alarm clock. I set it last night before I went to bed. Pardon me, I'll be right back.
What time is it, Mr. Thorndike?
Time? It's 10, exactly 10 o'clock.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Inspector. I must have forgotten to turn off the alarm this morning when Oliver woke me.
Yes, Latimer. And that forgetfulness is going to land you in the chair.
What do you mean?
I mean that I'm arresting you for the murder of Gregory Thorndike.
How does the inspector know that Robert Latimer is the murderer? In a moment, we'll give you the solution, but first...
Okay, let's take stock. Poor Gregory Thorndike is dead from stab wounds. Certainly a crime of passion. But do any of our suspects have any kind of motive? Also, what about this whole alarm clock thing? How could that possibly point out the killer? Now, I think I know, but let's let the inspector tell us for sure.
And now, back to the inspector.
Mr. Latimer, you said that you went to bed at 9 last night and that you slept right through the entire night.
But it's the truth.
I am afraid you're wrong, Latimer. The alarm clock just proved that. If you had gone to bed at 9 last night and set your alarm clock for 10, as you told me, it wouldn't have gone off at 10 this morning. but at 10 o'clock last night. Yes, Latimer, you murdered your uncle. And we'll soon get the story out of you at headquarters.
Okay, I must have looked at 50 alarm clocks from the 1940s on eBay, and not one of them could tell the difference between 10 p.m. and 10 a.m. So I guess the inspector's right. But wait. What if our killer was awakened at 10 p.m. and then reset it? That was still before 11 p.m. when Gregory was killed. That would mean his flimsy alibi would still be plausible. How about that?
Is that you say?
I have a bunch of things to say today. Did you hear about Twitter this past week? They removed all of the fake accounts that people were using to make you believe they had followers. Unfortunately for me, my account was deleted. But the kind folks at Twitter quickly restored it. While all the people I follow, about 750, and all my posts were restored, those of you that were following me were gone. Please help me restore my good name and follow me again. I promise to follow you back if I'm not already. Before all this happened, we had about 1,400 followers on Twitter. The truth is, that's not very many, but none of them were fake. While we're on the subject, if the truth be told, I would rather you follow the show on Facebook. It's so much easier to interact with, and as far as I know, Facebook doesn't delete anybody. There is something else you can do for the show. I'm looking to add a sponsor to pay the cost of the servers and hardware. On the main website, there's a banner labeled Listener Survey. It's about halfway down the sidebar. Some of you have noticed it and have taken it. It takes about 5 minutes to complete and asks questions about you, but requires no personal information. This information is used to show prospective sponsors my demographics. So please take a minute of your time to do this. It would really help me out a lot. If you've already taken the survey, thank you very much. As you know from last time, I took the week off and we had a replay. What did I do? Well, one of the things was to organize and go through every story that has ever been sent in by you guys over the last 7 years of the podcast. There have been over 100 keepable stories sent in. Amazing. It truly is. I've always planned that when I got enough stories, I was going to write a book. I think 100 plus hits the mark, and I've begun working on that in earnest. I'm kind of excited. Another great piece of news is that you guys keep sending the stories in, so much so that I had to start a story queue. We have 8 great tales, not including today's stories, in that queue waiting to air on the show. Thank you for that as well. You guys are the best. If you have a story and are wanting to get it on Ron's Amazing Stories, just go to ronsamazingstories.com, click on the story submission banner, and start typing. Next thing you know, your stories will be on the show. Right now, I'm looking for military stories for a special episode that I'm planning. So if you have a military story, come give it to me. I really would appreciate it. And now, here are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
This week, we have 3 stories to share that were sent in by you guys. They vary from crazy to funny to downright scary. Our first one comes from Joey Martinez in Orlando, Florida. This one, pure and simple, is a paranormal tale of goodness. Joey has called it, quite cleverly I might add, Pavlov's Response. Hello again, Ron. I'm still thrilled about you reading my previous story in RAS number 331, Kiss Me. I remember starting out by saying that it wasn't scary or a supernatural story, just a funny one. But I do have a ghost story that I'd like to share. It's about the only encounter I've ever had with the supernatural. I'd really love for you and your audience to hear this one. I hope you enjoy it, and yep, it's true. I'm pretty open-minded when it comes to the supernatural, particularly in the existence of ghosts, or lost souls as I like to think of them. I've always been frightened, intrigued, and thrilled by ghost stories my entire life, although I've never encountered one myself, until I was in my early 30s. It was the mid-90s in Miami, Florida. I worked at an office with co-workers who were also amongst my dearest friends. My friend, we'll call her Monica, suggested that we get together at her house to watch a movie later that night. Sounded like a great idea. We met at Monica's place, which was a charming townhouse built in the 1950s in the very heart of Coral Gables, Florida. That evening, we ate dinner, played board games, and then settled into the living room to watch the movie. I made myself comfortable sitting on the floor with my back against the sofa. Monica started the DVD player. The film turned out to be some romantic comedy, not really my favorite genre, but I watched it anyway until I began to feel sleepy. It was right at the moment between sleep and awake, I opened my eyes. About 3 feet in front of me stood a tall woman in her 40s, long brown hair, tan blouse, brown jacket, with a matching long skirt. Thinking that Monica had more company arrive, and not wanting to be rude, I shook my head and blinked my eyes to wake myself up. When I had finished, the tall woman was gone. Just vanished. I wouldn't have thought much of it, because I was sleepy, not interested in the film, and perhaps a little foggy in the head. The thought I had was that I must have superimposed someone from the movie into my field of vision. I'd almost dismissed it without saying a word when at that very moment Monica's dog, Pavlov, came running from the back of the house and began jumping on her back hind legs, barking at the very spot I had seen the woman. "Pavlov, stop it!" Monica shouted at the dog. "She's always doing that. I don't know what she's barking at." I wondered for a moment if I should say something. Then I did. "Perhaps she's barking at that woman I just saw standing there," I said. Everyone in the house stopped and looked at me with shocked silence. Someone even muted the TV. Monica became flustered and began trembling, saying, "I knew it. I knew there was a ghost in this house." To me, Pavlov's response, no pun intended, confirmed that someone or something was there. Monica said she'd do some research on the history of the house and came across a previous owner in the 1970s that seemed to fit the description I had given. The good news is that there was never anything harmful or any sort of dark or malicious activity at the house. Nothing other than more of Pavlov's responses. Joey Martinez, Orlando, Florida. Thank you, Joey. I love our second story. I think the paranormal ones are fun, but humorous tales make us laugh. A few weeks ago, my brother promised to be back with another story. If you remember, he has run the gambit of the impossible to the scary and then the head scratcher. He's back with an all new story that he has titled, "Be Careful What You Ask For." I was a parish pastor for more than 30 years. A chancy part of the job was marrying people. I say chancy because weddings, especially those involving people who aren't members of the church can go awry. I recall a very nice family, or so they seemed to me, who rented our building for their daughter's wedding. I was to preside over the event. Our church attracted many requests of this kind because we met in a beautiful white clapboard building complete with an impressive steeple amid the filbert orchards and raspberry fields of Oregon's Willamette Valley. The church was built in 1893, and it was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Its exterior had even been featured on national television advertisements, and because of this, it was sought after for weddings. For this particular celebration, our women's group was providing the reception in the church basement. It was an important money-making opportunity for them. I spent the morning helping the women just up until about an hour before the ceremony. I went to see how the wedding party was coming along. What I saw when I ascended the stairs staggered me. To make things absolutely perfect for their daughter's big day, the family had crowbarred the historic altar away from the wall. And it didn't stop there. They did the same thing to a 7-foot-high pulpit so that they could make the pictures better. In fact, they hauled it completely out of the building. It was pure vandalism committed against a national treasure, which also happened to be my church. What I said to them was short and simple. You are going to put everything back where it was, and you're going to do it right now. I let the ceremony go forward in deference to the work that the women had done on the reception, but at the next council meeting, church policy was to be dramatically changed. No longer was a simple donation required to rent our facility. The fee for non-members was now set at $1,000. Now, as a footnote, most of the churches in the area, many of them meeting in historic buildings like ours, had long ago set a similar fee. I suspect that they had their own stories to tell. But that's not actually the story I wanted to share today. This tale involves a genuinely nice couple who deserved a beautiful wedding and would have had one except they made the mistake of doing everything just as I asked. The couple was typical of many who chose the Willamette Valley to be their home in the 1980s. They loved the pretty fields bursting with every kind of you-pick berry and amazing peach orchards that yielded 5 separate crops each summer. They enjoyed canning, freezing, and drying all kinds of food. Each year they crafted wonderful jams and syrups, which they sold at fruit stands and farmers markets all over the valley. Their wedding plans fit their lifestyle. They chose an outdoor ceremony at a quiet country park with scattered trees and a pretty creek. Guests were invited to dress casually while the wedding party wore formal dress. Even the couple's little dog, who served as the best man, came wearing a black tie. To fit the occasion, I arrived robed in alb and chasuble with gold-threaded stoles, looking more papal than the Pope. The trouble actually began in our premarital counseling sessions. My practice was to insist that couples craft their own vows and speak them directly to each other. It was by their vows that they were making themselves husband and wife. I never asked to review the vows because they weren't my vows. However, I did suggest that they write them out so that they could read them during the ceremony, especially if they weren't comfortable speaking from memory. The wedding day dawned. It was unusually warm by Willamette Valley standards. There was no shade on the hillside, and the guests seemed to be having a tough time finding the place, so we had to delay things. All the while, the day got progressively hotter. As morning rolled into afternoon, the wedding party, including me, began suffering in our formal gowns. Eventually, I was able to start the wedding, and all went smoothly until we got to the vows. The bride got through her short, elegantly crafted, and perfectly memorized words. However, as she spoke, I watched the groom with growing concern. A combination of what I guessed was heat and nerves seemed to be taking its toll. His face looked clammy, and he was unsteady on his feet. When it was his turn to speak, he pulled out which appeared to be an 8x11.5 sheet of paper. He took one look at it and fainted straight to the ground. Seeing what happened, a couple of his friends lifted him up and helped him to the shade of a nearby tree. There they comforted the falling man and gave him water. In a minute or so he came to, but it was obvious he was not able to continue the ceremony. Fortunately, the vows were just about the last thing that had to be done, so I invited the crowd to regather in the shade. There we sat the groom in a lawn chair someone had provided, and I announced that I would recite his vows for him. I went back to the hill, picked up the paper he dropped, and returned to the group. I stood facing the bride while he sat in his chair, sipping water and watching us. That was to be the first time I saw his vows. While the bride had crafted beautiful sentences, her husband-to-be had prepared a statement that took up 3 pages of single-spaced 11-point type. I could see that this was going to be tough, but I bravely plowed into his massive tome. As soon as I started, I realized this guy didn't have a very good grasp of either spelling or grammar. Many of the sentences weren't sentences at all. That really didn't matter, because the spelling was so bad I couldn't determine what, if anything, he was trying to say. Infinitely worse, the parts I could decipher were either romantic dribble or so intimate in content, it was embarrassing. In that very moment, I thought, no wonder he fainted. Faced with the prospect of reading this hot mess in public, I was ready to faint too. But there was the bride looking up at me with her pretty eyes wide with expectation. The groom sitting right there waiting to hear his words be read, so I couldn't fake it. Somehow I had to read it all. I did my best turning incoherence into something that sounded like sentences. I slogged through the mushy parts pretty much as written out, but carefully edited those portions that ought to have earned me a smack on the jaw. Reading those 3 pages must have taken at least 10 minutes. At the time, it felt like an eternity. The event ended on a nice note. The groom recovered and joined family and friends in an organic potluck featuring sandwiches made with home-baked bread and every kind of fresh fruit dessert. I went home feeling I had done my job. I also learned a valuable lesson. Like in my first story, I was going to make a change to church policy. I would still require marriage partners to prepare their own vows and invite them to say what they wanted, but from now on, I would definitely be reviewing their work, just in case. Jim Thompson from Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Our last story comes from Jeremy Lucas in Bear, Delaware. Now, I just had to know more about the city of Bear. It was originally a small crossroads in a rural area about 14 miles south of Wilmington. The area consisted of small farms growing mainly corn and cattle. In the 1990s, Bear became a popular location for new housing developments and shopping centers. Too bad. I like the sound of rural farmhouses. Jeremy's story is scary, and there is no other word for that. Here is Jeremy's story. Hello, Ron. I've listened to you for about a year now, and I have to say, I hear and obey. I do have a story to tell. There's a place near Bear called Lum's Pond State Park. It has a pretty incredible history of the paranormal. Ghostly screams and pleading are said to come from the woods just off the hiking trail around the pond. They are believed to stem from an 1870s murder. Here is my story, and this is absolutely true. I was part of a ghost hunting group in the late 90s. We weren't anything professional, just a group of guys with recorders and cameras. We never encountered much until we came to Lum's Pond. One of the group knew a little about the crime and where the body was found. There's part of a hiking trail where the path navigates a little valley and then crosses a bridge. The spot is about 40 feet away from the bridge. Anyway, we were there at sunset and did our routine for about an hour. We took pictures, looked around, and asked the ghost questions next to the recorder in hopes of getting a ghostly verbal response. Nothing out of the ordinary seemed to happen. However, later we did review the tape. At first, there was nothing but normal forest noise and our own voices. Then we heard heavy breathing, a girl or woman sobbing, and finally, crazy whispering. We couldn't make out most of the words except for please and no, but we did hear a scream. Not really loud, more muffled, like someone was trying to scream with their mouth covered. Like I said, there were no women in our group, and we heard nothing of this sort during the actual session. My skin prickles as I write this. We had gone ghost hunting, hopefully to see some cool things and gain some interesting experience, but not for something like this. It was horrific. I can't fully describe how I felt as we listened to those tapes. Point of fact, we never went out ghost hunting again after that, and I have never been back to Lum's Pond. Jeremy Lucas, Bear, Delaware. Thank you for your story, Jeremy. So very creepy. I decided to do a little research, and Lum's Pond State Park does have a pretty dark history. One that goes way back. Before the pond was an official state park, it was just unprotected wild land. In the 1870s, a young girl ran away from an unhappy home. She ended up seeking refuge in the woods at Lum's Pond. Unfortunately for the young girl, she wasn't the only one in the woods. She stumbled upon a man camping. He captured and murdered the helpless runaway. The gruesome act took place on the very trails that visitors walk to this day. Authorities found her body shortly after she was murdered, and a massive manhunt to find the killer was launched. Sadly, he escaped into the night and disappeared forever. It's said that if you ever catch yourself there on a quiet evening, you might even hear the screams of the ghost girl coming from the woods. I tried to find out the name of the girl, but she's only listed as a runaway. Also, there seems to be some question as to whether it was the 1970s or the 1870s. On the website, Only in Your State, I found this witness account of another event from the pond. I quote it directly from their webpage. So, okay, the other day I was at Lum's Pond. I was just taking a walk in the woods, looking down to be careful, when I feel something rush past me. I look up and see a dark-haired girl sitting down reading. Then I'm up the playground and I felt it again. This time, the dark-haired girl is swinging and reading. Then I'm by the lake and I see her again. So I go up and ask, "What are you reading?" She says, "Ghost stories." I ask, "Why here?" She replies with something haunting, "Just trying to find my friends." I look up and I swear there were three mysterious dark spots on the lake, each with a white core. I look back at the girl, but she's gone. That's a terrifying story as well, and I think I'm going to avoid Lum's Pond State Park. My thanks to the Only in Your State website, and these were your stories. For our main story, I have a first. 2 weeks ago, we had Mark Nelson on the show, and we played the opening chapter to the book Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. It was the first time we played only a single chapter of a book. Well, we're about to do another first. But this time, we're going to play chapter 2 of that very same book. And I think you're going to enjoy it. While it's not as standalone as chapter 1, it's still a solid play. For those of you that did not hear chapter 1, this is what you missed. We met a creature called the Nipe. His spaceship was struck by an object and damaged. He realized his only hope was to murder his brother and crash land the ship on a distant planet. Here he would have to wait it out until rescued or could make other plans. So we rejoin the story after that crash. The book is titled Anything You Can Do, was first published in 1963, and is read for us by Mark Nelson.
Chapter 2 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. Wang Kulichenko pulled the collar of his uniform coat up closer around his ears and pulled the helmet and face mask down a bit. It was only early October, but here in the tundra country the wind had a tendency to be chill and biting in the morning, even at this time of year. Within a week or so, he'd have to start using the power pack on his horse to electrically warm his protective clothing and the horse's wrappings, but there was no necessity for that yet. He smiled a little, as he always did when he thought of his grandfather's remarks about such no-fangled nonsense. "Your ancestors, son of mine," he would say, "conquered the tundra and lived upon it for thousands of years without the need of such womanish things. Are there no men any more? Are there none who can face nature alone and unafraid without the aid of artifices that bring softness?" But Wang Kulichenko noticed, though out of politeness he never pointed it out, that the old man never failed to take advantage of the electric warmth of the house when the short days came and the snow blew across the country like fine white sand. And grandfather never complained about the lights or the television or the hot water, except to grumble occasionally that they were old and out of date, and that the mail-order catalog showed that much better models were available in Vladivostok. And Wang would remind the old man, very gently, that a paper forest ranger only made so much money, and that there would have to be more saving before such things could be bought. He did not ever remind the old man that he, Wang, was stretching a point to keep his grandfather on the payroll as an assistant. Wang Kulichenko patted his horse's rump and urged her softly to step up her pace just a bit. He had a certain amount of territory to cover, and although he wanted to be careful in his checking, he also wanted to get home early. Around him, the neatly planted forest of paper trees spread knotty, alien branches, trying to catch the rays of the winter waning sun. Whenever Wang thought of his grandfather's remarks about his ancestors, he always wondered, as a corollary, what those same ancestors would have thought about a forest growing up here, where no forest like this had ever grown before. They were called paper trees because the bulk of their pulp was used to make paper. They were of no use whatever as lumber, and they weren't really trees, and the organic chemicals that were leached from them during the pulping process were of far more value than the paper pulp. They were mutations of a smaller plant that had been found in the temperate regions of Mars, and purposely changed genetically to grow in the Siberian tundra country, where the conditions were similar to, but superior to, their natural habitat. They looked as though someone had managed to crossbreed the Joshua tree with the cypress, and then persuaded the result to grow grass instead of leaves. And the photosynthesis of those grass-like blades depended on an iron-bearing compound that was more closely related to hemoglobin than to chlorophyll, giving them a rusty red color instead of the normal green of earthly plants. In the distance, Wang heard the whining of the wind increase, and he automatically pulled his coat a little tighter, even though he noticed no increase in the wind velocity around him. Then, as the whine became louder, he realized that it was not the wind. He turned his head toward the sound and looked up. For a long minute he watched the sky as the sound increased in volume, but he could see nothing at first. Then he caught a glimpse of motion, a dot that was hard to distinguish against the cloud-mottled gray sky. What was it? An air transport in trouble? There were two transporter routes that passed within a few hundred miles of here, but no air transport he had ever seen made a noise like that. Normally, they were so high up as to be both invisible and inaudible. Must be trouble of some sort. He reached down to the saddle pack without taking his eyes from the moving speck and took out the radiophone. He held it to his ear and thumbed the call button insistently. Grandfather, he thought with growing irritation as the seconds passed. Wake up! Come on, old dozer! Rouse yourself from your dreams! At the same time, he checked his wrist compass and estimated the direction of flight of the dot and its direction from him. He'd at least be able to give the airline authorities some information if the ship fell. He wished there were some way to triangulate its height, velocity, and so on, but he had no need for that kind of thing, so he hadn't the equipment. "Yes, yes," came a testy, dry voice through the earphone. Quickly, Wang gave his grandfather all the information he had on the flying thing. By now, the whine had become a shrill roar, and the thing in the air had become a silver-pink fish shape. "I think it's coming down very close to here," Wang concluded. "You call the authorities and let them know that one of the aircraft is in trouble. I'll see if I can be of any help here. I'll call you back later." "As you say," the old man said hurriedly. He cut off. Wang was beginning to realize that the thing was a spaceship, not an airship. By this time he could see the thing more clearly. He had never actually seen a spacecraft, but he'd seen enough of them on television to know what they looked like. This one didn't look like a standard type at all, and it didn't behave like one, but it looked and behaved even less like an airship, and Wang knew enough to be aware that he did not necessarily know every type of spaceship ever built. In shape, it resembled the old rocket-propelled jobs that had been used for the first probings into space more than a century before, rather than the fat ovoids he was used to. But there were no signs of rocket exhausts, and yet the ship was very obviously slowing, so it must have an inertia drive. It was coming in much lower now, on a line north of him, headed almost due east. He urged the mare forward in order to try to keep up with the craft, although it was obviously traveling at several hundred miles an hour, hardly a horse's pace. Still, it was slowing rapidly, very rapidly. Maybe. He kept the mare moving. The strange ship skimmed along the treetops in the distance and disappeared from sight. Then there was a thunderous crash, a tearing of wood and foliage, and a grinding, plowing sound. For a few seconds afterward, there was silence. Then there came a soft rumble, as of water beginning to boil in some huge but distant samovar. It seemed to go on and on and on. And there was a bluish, fluctuating glow on the horizon. Radioactivity, Wang wondered. Surely not an atomic-powered ship without safety cutoffs in this day and age. Still, there was always the possibility that the cutoffs had failed. He pulled out his radiophone and thumbed the call button again. This time there was no delay.
"Yes?"
"How are the radiator detectors behaving there, Grandfather?"
"One moment, I shall see."
There was a silence. Then,
"No unusual activity, young Wang. Why?"
Wang told him. Then he asked,
"Did you get hold of the air transport authorities?" "Yes, they have no missing aircraft, but they're checking with the space fields. The way you describe it, the thing must be a spaceship of some kind."
"I think so, too. I wish I had a radiation detector here, though. I'd like to know whether that thing is hot or not. It's only a couple of miles away, maybe a little more. And if that blue glow is ionization caused by radiation, it's much too close for comfort."
I think any source that strong would register on our detectors here, young Wang," said the old man in his dry voice. "However, I agree that it might not be the pinnacle of wisdom to approach the source too closely." "Clear your mind of worry, Grandfather," Wang said. "I accept your words of wisdom and will go no nearer. Meanwhile, you had best put in a call to Central Headquarters Fire Control. There's going to be a blaze, if I'm any judge, unless they get here fast with plenty of fire equipment." "I'll see to it," said his grandfather, cutting off. The bluish glow in the sky had quite died away by now, and the distant rumbling was fading too. And, oddly enough, there was not much smoke in the distance. There was a small cloud of gray vapor that rose, streamer-like, from where the glow had been, but even that was dissipated fairly rapidly in the chill breeze. Quite obviously, there would be no fire. After several more minutes of watching, he was sure of it. There couldn't have been much heat produced in the explosion, if it could really be called an explosion. Then Wang saw something moving in the trees between himself and the spot where the ship had come down. He couldn't see quite what it was, there in the dimness under the hanging grass-like red strands from the trees, but it looked like someone crawling.
"Hello there," he called out. "Are you hurt?"
There was no answer. Perhaps whoever it was did not understand Russian. Wang's command of English wasn't too good, but he called out in that language. Still there was no answer. Whoever it was had crawled out of sight. Then he realized it couldn't be anyone crawling. No one could even have run the distance between himself and the ship in the time since it had hit, much less crawled. He frowned. A wolf, then? Possibly. They weren't too common, but there were still some of them around. He unholstered the heavy pistol at his side. As he slid the barrel free, he became the first human being ever to see the Knipe. For an instant, as the Knipe came out from behind a tree 15 feet away, Wang Kulichenko froze as he saw those four baleful violet eyes glaring at him from the snouted head. Then he jerked up his pistol to fire. He was much too late. His reflexes were too slow by far. The Knipe launched himself across the intervening space in a blur of speed that would have made a leopard seem slow. Two of the alien's hands slapped aside the weapon with a violence that broke the man's wrist, while other hands slammed at the human skull. Wang Kulichenko hardly had time to be surprised before he died. End of Chapter 2.
That's a pretty great story, and that chapter still, sort of, stands alone. What will the Knipe do now that he's made his first kill? Based on your feedback, I may have an answer for you on the next podcast. Please take a minute and tell me if we should go back to complete stories or continue with this book next time. Go to our fan page at facebook.com/Ron's Amazing Stories or head to the main website and leave a comment. Or if you really want to help out, tweet it too at RAS Podcast. And by the way, while you're there, remember to refollow us. And now, this.
As read by Amazing Stories. Read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we have something pretty special, and I'm very excited to present it to you. My hope for this segment was that you guys would read your stories here, and that is exactly what we have today. Our longtime friend Tom Williams is back. A few weeks ago, we had a story from Tom called Growing Up. The feedback from you guys was off the charts. Well, Tom is back with part two of Growing Up, and this time he reads it himself. He calls it Growing Up, or Almost Not. Take it away, Tom.
Growing Up, or Almost Not. I remember going to my grandmother's farm in the summers. Her old house was at the end of one of those typical dirt roads of Alabama. The road ended exactly under the old oak tree. She had no grass around her old home, only sand. If you could get rich on sand, we would have inherited a fortune from her. But that didn't turn out to be the case. Whenever we kids finished playing in the yard, she always gave us a broom made of wired together branches from a bush or a tree and made us rake the sand neatly so that it wouldn't look like a mess when you finished tromping all over my yard. This also reminds me of her saying not to hold hands and jump over the homemade broomstick or we would be married to each other. Just like the slaves used to do long ago. These were her exact words. We always followed those instructions closely because I didn't want to marry my cousin anyways. I like girls better. The wooden house typically for the South was on concrete blocks and rather high off the ground. I presume the air that flowed underneath kept the place cool on those hot summer days. To paint a better picture of the old homestead, it was surrounded by large fields, with sweet corn normally in the back, and to the front she raised sometimes peanuts and sometimes peas and string beans. Since the house was in the middle of their land, which was granted to their great-grandfather from the Indian lands, no room was spared for anything other than what they could grow, eat, and sell to maintain their existence. Except there was one old oak tree for shade in the front yard. From this old tree hung a rope with a used tire at the end for the kids to swing on. That is, when it wasn't too hot to move. The porch ran the length of the front of the house and was very useful for kids to pull the old plow horse around to the side and mount and ride. The porch was also used as a second dining room for the additional kids on family get-together days. The adults ate inside, and the kids would always take their plates with mounds of fried chicken and fresh sweet corn, cornbread, sweet peas, out to the porch or steps to eat and act silly. Oh, I almost forgot the tall glass of oversweetened iced tea or lemonade that made you pucker with each mouthful. Grandmother would also make her own ice cream. Now for the inside of the old farmhouse. The rooms were sparse, to say the least. The kitchen consisted only one table and a wood-burning stove. I remember chopping wood for her, and she would cook the meals, delicious meals. And she would send me to the well to fetch the water she needed, with a warning, "Be careful at the edge of the well. It is caving in on one side, so don't go there. Lower the bucket from the other side so you don't cave in. I don't have a rope to haul you out before you drown." I'm older now, so you see, I follow instructions pretty well. Just to give you a clearer picture, her lights in the house were only electric wires hanging from the center of the room and a bare bulb at the end with a chain to turn it on or off. And a toilet? Yes. She had an outhouse, but in the room at night we had a slop jar with a lid. Another warning from Grandmother. When you get up at night to do your thing, don't kick over the slop jar or you'll have to clean up the mess yourself in the morning. That wasn't my problem, though. My problem was those southern mosquitoes. When they didn't make that high-pitched sound, you knew they landed. It was awful hard to keep the sheets over your head all night in 90-degree heat. Southern mosquitoes are smart, too, and have lots of patience. My father once said that he overheard the mosquitoes arguing whether to eat us on the spot or take us into the field out back in order to take their time. Yeah, somehow I didn't believe him. Don't know why, but that's another story. Besides the old plow horse, Grandmother had a billy goat. We hooked the goat up to the little red wagon, and we would indulge ourselves, my cousin and me, of the same age, to a fun trip around the yard, until he lost interest, the goat, I mean. B.S., growing up, I was shocked to hear that he wasn't my cousin at all, even though we're of the same age. He was my uncle. Okay, not a point of interest except for me, maybe. At this point, all animal lovers, I ask you to either shut us off or cover your ears. I digress. One day, my cousin, uncle, decided to ride the billy goat bareback. He coaxed the old goat over and mounted him, grabbing both horns firmly in hand. Then the goat decided that he wasn't something he was going to cotton to. The goat lowered his head and ran towards the farmhouse, and remember how high those houses were off the ground. The goat darted under the house. I then heard a hollow thump, 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 thump about 6 or 7 times. The goat exited the other side of the house, still with my cousin, uncle, firmly mounted and holding tight. I managed to stop the charging animal, and my whatever fell to the ground with deep gashes in his forehead and glazed eyes. I asked several times, why didn't he let go? And just as those who have been reported missing time as alien abductees, he couldn't answer or even remember. And as the song goes, this is my story, and I'm sticking to it. Yours truly, Tom.
That was really cool. First off, I want to thank Tom for it. It was special and read by a really cool individual. There is a backstory that goes with all of this, and to Tom I say, you are the best. For those of you who don't know, Tom lives in Germany and has sent in more of these tales from his youth. I can't wait to share them with you. I think we just might need a Tom Williams segment. What do you guys think? Another listener story-filled podcast. Please keep that going by sending in your stories. I want to thank all of the contributors this week. Poor Gregory Thorndike, Tom Williams, Joey Martinez, Jim Thompson, Jerry Lucas, and of course, the City of Bear, Delaware. See you all next time. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's so easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There, you're going to find every link you'll need. We're on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and so many other services. Pick one and do leave some feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.